Welcome, everybody, to tonight's talk and podcast, The Olmec, the Aztecs, the Toltecs, and the Maya. I'm very excited about tonight. I never thought I'd enjoy doing this so much, but I am. Sharing with you all the wisdom of the ages through the different cultures of the shamans, the shamanism practices of the different areas of the world. Tonight we're focusing on Mesoamerica, a historical region of North America, more Central America really, and it extends from Central Mexico through Belize, Guatemala, El Salvador, Honduras, Nicaragua, and northern part of Costa Rica. It's a cultural area defined by the specific culture and cultural traits. And so we're going to be exploring the indigenous cultures of that particular area. The area starts about from 7,000 before Christ with the domestication of cocoa, maize, beans, tomato, avocado, vanilla, squash, and chili, as well as the domestication of the first dogs and turkey. They are very, they have a lot of depth in their mythology and their religious traditions. And we're going to be exploring those different cultures. They were known for the trade routes, interconnecting network through either routes or rivers or water. And they exchanged luxurious goods such as obsidian, jade, cocoa, cinnabar, hematite, and ceramic. They also knew the wheel and metallurgy, but it's not so what was so important to them as a culture. The first culture that we'll look at is the Olmec. The Olmec civilization is placed around 1400 before Christ, but could go as far as 1600 before Christ. And the water canals and the environment and encourage a dense concentration of the population. Now, this culture, remember what I did said last week, when a culture has arts, when a culture has sculptures, decorative objects, it means that they lived in times of peace and they were able to invest their time and knowledge in something other than just survival. Or growing food. The Olmec Center shifted to La Venta around 400 before Christ. So they lived in a certain area, and the scholars have yet to determine the cause of why they actually, the culture itself, became extinct around 400 to 350 before Christ. However, the remnant of their art has gone as far as Peru. So based on that, we know that they had a large influence and they populated a large area. They were the first to have writing and symbols. They invented popcorn, the number zero, the calendar, and a ball game, and perhaps, what we'll see later, a compass. The Olmec religious activities were performed by a combination of full-time priests and shaman. Now we're going to discover today that priests and shamans are very different. And this is why it's important to talk about shamanism. Because people confuse their role and they think that they did the same thing, which they did not. Although they had writing, we have very little to go on, because after the conquistadors from Spain came, they destroyed a lot of the written books that existed at the time. And what survived were a lot of it is based on the accounts by priests or friars or scribes hired by the conquistadors. And so everything is kind of sort of been tainted by the beliefs of the Catholic Church, that they were savages and they needed to be brought to the truth, as we can say. And this truth belonged to the church and not the indigenous people. And it's why at that time, and this is why mystery schools exist, because in order for all knowledge not to be lost, certain things, the holders of the secrets, the holder of the true knowledge, then have to go into hiding as to not be persecuted or eliminated. Case in point, Don Miguel Ruz, which is a Nagal, a shaman for the Toltec wisdom, was kind of chastised at first when he shared with non-Toltec people the revelation of the inner wisdom of the mysteries of the Toltecs. And we're going to be studying those tonight. So you're going to understand that there was no big mystery. However, it was a different truth than what the conquistadors were trying to spread across the area. The best way to conquer a people is always to integrate them to your society and make them live by your rules. And so if they accept your rules, there's less chance that they'll revolt or oppose the forces. So one of the things that's very interesting, and the reason why the conquistador had it easy in a way, is because a lot of the things are similar, right? The truth is the truth. You can't change it. So there were part of the things in the Catholic Church that tie in when we talk about resurrection or we talk about the cross. The indigenous people recognize those symbols as part of their own particular beliefs, and so they thought it would be okay. So now the archaeologists are having remnants of that cultures of things that survive from burial sites and the likes, and through those they try to explain the beliefs of these people. In the mythology of the Americas, the authors explain that religion at first for the people, the indigenous people of Mesoamerica, was based on a philosophy of love, of consciousness, and of union with the creator of the universe. So really, it's not that much different than the original message, but that Jesus might have taught. But we know that what happened from the teaching of Jesus and what we have today is there's a big hole in between. So now, I wasn't going to mention this, but I found that Mr. Ruz is a part of the Knights of the Eagle. And so since he is, I will mention and explain what it is so you have a better understanding. Much like the Catholic Church, who had the Order of the Templars, who was defending the church and defending the pilgrims, in Mesoamerica, there was two such orders. The first order was the Knights of the Tiger. It was a caste of initiates. So much like last week when we were talking about Druids, there's always the initiates or the apprentice, and then there's the higher caste. In this case, the Knights of the Tiger were initiates fighting for the attainment of spirituality. So they were not necessarily warriors, as they might have first thought. They were fighting for spirituality. The Knights of the Eagle are warriors of the sun, and they were the higher companions of the Knights of Tiger, meaning that they are full-fledged knights, and they are aware of all the secrets and the mysteries and are practicing them in their everyday life, which is what the knights are all about, the warriors of the truth. They're not fighting a war on the outside, they're winning the war on the inside, which is what we're all about to learn tonight. Now, I want to say that some people approached me and they said, well, why would you include the Aztecs? Aztecs were murdering people, they were making human sacrifices. That was a practice of the Aztecs, and we'll see that the Aztecs are claiming to be descendants of the Toltecs. And so we have to include them because it's important to learn from history and from the past. You see, if we forget what the past is teaching us, then we're deemed to remake the same mistakes over and over. And one of the things that happened with the Aztecs was that they misunderstood the mysteries, and they took the sacrifice and resurrection literally, as opposed to more mythical or philosophical, if you will. And so we have to differentiate what the commoners and the people who are not aware of the mystery tend to think things very literal as opposed to the more spiritual aspect of the teachings. And so we're going to seek the original teaching and not the perverse version that later required human sacrifices to the gods. Now, another important civilization that lived in that area were the Mayas. They were there for a very long period of time, from 2000 before Christ, when we first saw the development of agriculture in the earliest village. And by, how do we know this? Because the Maya had a different type of art than the Olmecs. And then we start seeing their decorative figurines and statues and pieces of art in those areas. And that's how we know this typical culture covered this much of area. And it goes from 2000 before Christ all the way to their end in 1697. So this is a period of about 4,000 years in which the Mayas evolved, built complex cities. They also developed markets and commerce in between the different areas. And so a lot of their arts is spread all over the large area, all the way down to Peru. And there's also resemblance from their structure, from Chichen Itza in the north to all the way to Peru. Very similar structures based on similar beliefs, similar iconography, and similar writing. Their end came, of course, with the invasion of the Spaniards. And the last Maya city fell in 1697. Now, what's interesting is that the Maya are also connected with the Toltecs. And so we can see that these people all interacted with each other. There were merchants that were traveling, and they would be the equivalents of the bards with the Celts. They would travel and they would exchange stories and they would exchange learning with the people. The idea was not for the merchant to become rich. It was for to have a rich life. And in the meantime, exchange some goods. And so the similarity in architecture, iconography, which is images, comes to tell us that to a certain degree, each of these cultures were influencing one another. The Mayas weren't savages, unlike what the conquistadors reported in their journals. They had a king, they had a political system, they had vast trades, they had several cultural exchanges with outside their borders. Their language even survived to this day and is still spoken today. Their mathematical system, their astrology, their calendar tells us they were well-versed in number, the movement of the stars, and they had, obviously, their religion and mythology. The Maya household entered their dead beneath the floors of their house because they believed that their ancestors, although not in physical form anymore, were able to guide us in the living world. So they believed that there was a link between the dead and the living. So they were protective, and the lineage was passed in from father to son. And so there's a prominent male ancestor's emphasis in the house, but all ancestors were beneath the household. And for the royalty, that's where the pyramids come into play. They would build the tomb on top of the older tomb, and so and ants became the pyramid. For the Maya, their religious practice and mystery of origin is written in the Popol Vuh. The Popol Vuh is written in Latin from the early colonial times, probably transcribed from a hieroglyphic book. And so this Popol Vuh recounts the mythical creation of the world and the different legends populating their belief system. What's interesting is that for all of the Mesoamerican cultures, although the names may differ from one culture to the next, so here we're talking Olmec, Maya, Toltec, and Aztec, the stories are the same. And it's always the principal worship of the feathered serpent deity. The problem with most myths is that without the proper teaching to accompany this wisdom, they just become stories. And so having the Papa Vol is an indication that there was a rich historical culture, great teaching, and spirituality existed. However, that also means that we're just getting the stories, and we have to dig in the deeper meaning of what that means. So now, because we can contact the souls of the dead, the Maya viewed this structure of the world based on 13 levels of heaven and 9 for the underworld. And this soul's journey began while you were in the womb of your mother and did not end when you died. But again, you could attain the higher steps of heaven in your lifetime. You didn't have to die, but there's a part of you that has to die. So hopefully I can make all that clear tonight. But it was all part of this soul's journey, descending into this mortal world, confronting all the temptation and desires to ascend out of the darkness, so be resurrected, and then be able to be godlike. And again, you could do this while still living inside your body. This is very much like the Asian cultures and the concept of enlightenment, right? So once you did die, there was 4 places the soul would eventually go, depending on the way you lived your life. If you had the choice between 3 heavens, which is kind of nice, and then 1 place that was more of a darkness place. So in order to attend those heavens, you had to go on a journey of several obstacles. It's during the soul's growth, during the living years, that then if you gathered enough wisdom, you could surpass the obstacles and finally lead yourself to the right heaven. So the first of those heavens is called the Land of Water and Mist. Very reminiscent as well with the Celtic culture, right? It's a paradise where pleasure is found, but it's material pleasures, but purer than on earth. And happiness is conceived with simple-minded, but still materialistically oriented pleasures. You would be there for 4 years before your soul would be reincarnated. So that means that they believed the soul had a journey while on earth. While the sojourn on earth was terminated, then your soul would end up in one of those 4 places. And after 4 years, you would be reincarnated. So they believe in reincarnation. Then there's the land of the fleshless. If you're in that heaven, because you have shed away your materialistic pleasures, then you enter a paradise where you could find the practical application of the teaching that you had learned during your lifetime. You were unattached with the physical body and detached of materialistic pleasure, and you could enjoy being in a space of love and compassion. And then the third place, the most desirable place, would be the House of the Sun, where those who achieve full enlightenment and deserve eternal happiness, like Nirvana for the Buddhist people, and there were no reincarnation that followed that stage. So just like the Buddhists, they believed that the cycle of reincarnation would eventually end once you were able to shed away from the material desires and be able to find the truth of the soul. But you had to do that. This learning, this growing, has to happen while you're incarnated on earth. Now, for those who did not go to those 3 heavens, would enter a place that was dark in the center of the earth. It's a much less desirable place. However, unlike the hell of the Christians, the souls don't suffer. Rather, they endure a very colorless existence, much like purgatory, if you will, a land of nothing, of aloneness, and of feeling lost. However, that didn't go on forever, because the goal is always to achieve enlightenment. Then the idea was to spend 4 years there, reflect on your actions, and try again. Part of, you see the number four, right? The number four is very important. When a certain system of belief is built on often a numerical system. For the Christianity, we'd say it's built on number three because of the Trinity, right? The Holy Trinity. For the Mesoamericans, it was built on number 4 or 5. And this is where the cross comes in. The cross was not a symbol that was strange to them because it represented the four cardinal direction. It represented the east, the south, the west, and the north. And so the cross to them is coming a full circle. Each of these directions had animals, birds, and gods associated to them, as well as color. So when I talked about Native Americans' beliefs in the past, I did say that there's color associated to the different directions. Depending on which tribe we're talking about, again, even in Mesoamerica, the color changes. Now, there's the color change because they couldn't paint yellow because they had nothing to make yellow with, and so they picked another color in exchange for it. I'm not quite sure about that, but that could be a possibility. It could also be that, depending on where you are, if we're in the northern hemisphere, the stars are not in the same place. If you're in the southern hemisphere, everything changes. So in the same sense, if you're not located in the same area, maybe the color took on all new meaning. However, for the Maya, north was white, east was red, south was yellow, and west was black. But for the Nahuas, the east was yellow, the south was red, the west was black, the north was white. This is the system I go by. The Nahuas, a lot of people have not really heard about them because very little exists to this day. And so not very much has been written about them. But what's interesting is when we compare the language used by the Mayas, the Toltecs, the Olmecs, and the Aztecs, they all are based on the Nahua's language. So much like we can say French, Spanish, Italian is all based on a Latin form of language. So they're easily recognizable. And even though the pronunciation may vary from country to country, someone with a attuned ear can actually pick up, not necessarily speak, but they can actually pick up and communicate with the different tribes. And so it was noticed that when we study the actual language of all these different tribes, that at the basic, it's all the form of Nahuas that comes out. And so, since they all share their own basic belief of creation myth and their teaching, it's okay to say or assume that it was the actual Nahuas teaching that has been spread through all this time and space. So the time I don't know if you ever had the expression Indian time. I live by Indian time. So I believe that if something happens, there's no reason to get upset. Because if you get delayed, it's because something is either important and needs to take place, or you're prevented from having an accident later on the road, or you're avoiding some sort of disaster. The natives of the Mesoamerica are very much aligned with that thinking, that thought. There is the in the cross, the horizontal line, representing the passing of time, passing of season, what is transitionary and perishable. So everything in nature is born in the spring, lives during the summer, dies in the fall, and is reborn in the spring again. And that's the passing of time. And so we have to admit that time passes, things grow, things die. However, the vertical line of the cross represents the line of living in the now, the ever constant and the ever present. What is eternal and what is stable and what is unchangeable. So there's an aspect which is represented by the material world, the third dimension, which evolves constantly, is in constant change. And then there's the aspect of the spiritual world. What is inside, the soul, what is eternal, is constantly living in the now. So the Nahuas were the ancestors to them all. And so as such, we will, as a common originator, we will feel their influence through all the different cultures. And we will then explore the mystery school from a Toltec perspective, which is the one that's been passed down and still exists today. Because of Don Miguel Ruiz, we were able to obtain this information that is still maintained and alive, just like the Druid knowledge. There's still the ancient wisdom that is still being shared with the few initiates. Now, what's interesting is that, again, I always like it when I see that, you know, they regarded the savages because they wore loincloths, or uncivilized because they didn't have advanced weaponry like the Spaniards did. However, in their culture, they speak of five different ages. The first age was about living in darkness, led by instinctive power and much closer to an animal form. And none of those survive. Now, if you know, I have a little thing for science. If you look through science, science will tell you there's the Cro-Magnon, and then there's the Neanderthals, and then they're wondering what happened in between. Something seems to be missing. This is the age that the Nahuas are talking about. Everybody got extinguished because they didn't get it right. So they tried, and there was a new era. And this era was an era of pure spirit. And you could live on Earth, but because you were pure spirit, you could observe matter, but you weren't matter yourself. The redeeming principle of what you came here to learn was not being learned, because we were challenged. There was no lessons to learn. We were just observing. And so that ended in that area. And then there came the time of the rain by fire. So again, human populated the earth, but it could be the equivalent either of volcanic eruptions or meteors falling from the sky. However, whichever form it was, again, humanity got extinguished. Now, we know today, based on science, that if a volcano large enough erupts, it will destroy the environmental system in the serenity of the surrounding the volcano. But if there's multiple volcanic eruptions provoked by tectonic plates moving, the amount of ashes covering the sky could also make the earth inhabitable, because it would become too cold, because the rays of the suns are not going through the atmosphere because of the ashes in the sky. And that would be enough to create an ice age. And so the fourth era that preceded this current age was the one that was destroyed by a flood. Now, isn't it fascinating that in the Bible we read about it? We're like, yeah, okay, maybe, you know, maybe if you want to believe that there was a big storm, it rained for 40 days. And but now we're hearing that even in Mesoamerica, they talk about this flood, this destruction of humanity or human settlements, where humans had to start over again. The story of the flood is now in the Celtic culture. It's now in the Jewish culture, Judeo-Christian Christian culture, and now even in Mesoamerica, there was such a flood that destroyed all life on Earth. And from there stems now the age that we're in. Now, the Toltec culture ruled around Tula, Hidalgo, and Mexico from a circa of 900 to 1521. So again, the arrival of the Spaniards invading. Now, did the Toltec culture completely disappear? No. But it does make it harder to have this population live the way they lived back then. again, it was the Nahuatl language that was used by the Toltecs. And Toltec means artisan or artists. And we'll see, based on Don Miguel Ruiz's wisdom, that it was the artisan of dream. Now, leaves us with the Aztecs. The Aztecs period was very short. It was from 1300 to 1521. They were known as a migratory force that was around Colorado and made its way all the way down south. They were a warlike culture, and they tended to destroy and go to war. However, they say that their ancestors were the Toltecs. Now, were they directly the Toltecs, or were they the teaching of the Toltecs that guided them? There's some deformation there in history. The most important part is that the Aztecs took something of the Toltec, which was their mysteries, not understanding what it meant, and decided to turn what is the inner sacrifice of ego, and started to literally officiate human sacrifices to appease the gods. They also misused medicinal plant, inebriating themselves and perversing the true knowledge or the experience behind those plants. And so by the time the conquistador arrived, they were completely lost. And so they thought the conquistador were the reincarnation of their gods coming. And, you know, there's a cartoon movie with those two guys who end up in the Aztecs, and they arrive with the conquistador, and you can see the guy's looking at his book, and he's looking at the soldier, and he's like, oh, that's him, right? They think, the Aztec thought that their greatest god was a god of war, because that's the way they live their lives. You have to understand that the way you live your life is the way you create the story, and so you transform the story or the meaning of the story to fit, to make you feel at ease with your actions. Right? Otherwise, you'd be riddled with guilt. And so the Aztecs did perform human sacrifice, but that's not part of the wisdom that they were brought up upon. Their mythology, their main deities, were very similar in correspondence with the Greek and Egyptian mysteries. Even Don Miguel Cruz does this parallel. And he even goes as far as to say that Buddha and the Jesus teaching relate to the Toltec teaching because they are the truth. And so if you go to the truth of the teachings and recognize that what is being taught is the same, then it's just the practice that differs. The purpose of these talks is not to convince you that one is better than the other. The purpose of these talks is, on the contrary, to show you that they're all teaching you the same basic knowledge. Now, I'm trying to open different doors for you, and that you enter the door through the Toltec door, that you eventually enter to the Greek mysteries, that's not important. If the practice of the Toltecs fits your lifestyle and you're able to embrace it and to find this inner peace within yourself, then I am happy for you, because that's all that matters. I'm simply here to show you there are different doors that all lead to the same place. So you can imagine it as a circular room, and then eventually you'll come full circle. And that's what I'm offering to you. So there's no judgment. It's not that one is better than the other. It's more about the fact that each and every single one can attract you in a most particular way. And maybe you'll understand more from this way of explaining things, be it tonight, the Toltec way, or be it one of the other talks that we're doing. So as a whole, we have two systems in place. We have the priest system, and then we have the shamanic system. The priest system was for the ruling class. It was for outdoor large ceremonies, more officiating in regards to the sun, the planting of the crops, or the harvesting of the crops. that's more what a priest was in that system. The shamanic role was more of that of a healer, of a guide, and a way shower. So that's why we're more interested in the shamanic practices and not so much about the actual ceremonies for themselves. There are four pillars to the spirituality in the Nuas. There's the fact that there's a descent of an heavenly being that is activated through the materialization on earth, meaning that your soul, you're pure and divine, and you enter a physical body on earth. Then the human must sacrifice his ego, his material self, in order to escape the principle and then reincarnate as a pure soul, recognizing its divine self in a human body. In order for this to take place, the soul must undergo the trials of the duality of matter. It's part of understanding through the suffering that it's all beauty, it's all love. That is why we're here on this planet. And so then you can overcome the material world and you recognize your own divine self and you are reborn in the same human body, but this time as a spiritual being, experimenting nature and the material world in a spiritual way, bringing spiritual joy. Now, the soul is immortal, right? So we remember that it can go through the heavens or it can be reincarnated. And then it can eventually stop the cycle of reincarnation. In order to help the people go through this transition and hopefully end the cycle of reincarnation, we are given a Nagal. A Nagal is a name for a shaman in the Toltec culture. It's also can be a stolen animal that is associated with you for your protection and for your growth. You would either find your spiritual totem animal if one crossed the threshold of the door while you were born, and if not, you could go on a spiritual quest, meaning spending time in nature, and the first animal you would encounter once you've reached your designated area would be your totem animal. The soul was believed to reside in the heart and not the mind. This is very important because sometimes we say, oh, I know this, but I can't seem to be able to do it. It's because your mind is disagreeing with what's in your soul. And the soul could leave the body and travel while you were alive. So this was communing with the souls of the dead or going to different places and different times. This was part of the cultural fact of those cultures. The calendar that they created. So everything that has survived was survived mainly because it was engraved on rock. The reason why this is so important is because all the meaning is into the imagery, right? But it's hard to decipher because it's imagery and not text. And even, you know, if we read any kind of text that it's from Buddha or Jesus, if you don't have a teacher, if you don't have a guide, sometimes your search can be arduous to understand and comprehend. In the same sense, the calendar existed. And it explains what happens or what is the journey. So it's not just a calendar of days. It's not just a calendar of marking time. There was also the complexity behind the calendar was that it reflected the soul's journey. It's described in the calendar as 20 days, but it's much longer than 20 days. It's more like 20 steps, if you will. So the first step is that you begin your journey inside the womb when you are created. Then, in a lot of cultures, they recognize that it's at the third trimester that the soul becomes linked with the actual baby. And so at that third trimester is when the spirit of breath or the soul becomes part of the baby in the womb. He is then born of water, right? If you're familiar with giving birth, you know that the water accompanied the birth, and that's what it means. And so it's not necessarily an actual baptism of water, just being washed with the water of the womb is part of being born of water. The next step is that you begin to know evil. And I'll explain what evil is for the Toltecs. He then gathers together all the experiences of life, meaning that, as I said, it's much longer than one day. It's your life. And so as you go through life, you go through different experiences. Evil meaning lies, meaning gossip, meaning anger, meaning sadness, meaning everything that does not bring you joy or love. That is what is considered evil. Okay, so we're not talking about the devil. We're not talking about a shape or a human form or anything. We're talking about the insides, the emotions, and everything that detaches you from love, from joy, is evil. And that's the way the Toltecs view the evil. So at the end, you die. This is an important step because here, you may die a physical death, or it may be that as you gather those life experiences, you overcome your desires and you overcome ego. And so the part of you that is attached to the material world dies. And so therefore, you overcome death. So you're still alive, but no longer attached to the material world. If you have questions, please type them on. I'll try to answer as we go along. And so you then must struggle to keep into the light. You must struggle to keep overcoming death because every day is a new day. Every day comes with its challenges. And every day you have to choose love. You have to choose compassion. You have to choose joy. It is then that you reap the rewards of all your efforts and you enter to the inner depth, the your darkest area. So it's like peeling the onion, if you will. And every peel of the onion, you go deeper and deeper until eventually you go through what's called a dark night of the soul, or in this case, the burning without flame. So you get purified through fire. In the Christian religion, that is to receive the Holy Ghost. It's to receive the flame. It's to be cleansed. At this point, now that you are cleansed, you begin the long process of living your life in this state. And this is what the warriors of the tigers and the warriors, the knights of the eagles, are doing. They're in constant process of climbing the ladder towards the light until you're washed entirely clean. And then you become... you obtain the full consciousness of the light. The last piece, once you have this realization, once you obtain the enlightenment, the last piece of ash or the last piece of attachment finally washes away from you. You are made perfect because you then realize your divine nature is manifested. This is like to be a child, right? So it's to be pure, it's to be innocent, but innocent yet wise. And that's the whole process, is to start as a child and then return to that childlike mind of love and honesty and spontaneity and joy. At that point, you become one with divinity. So, again, very important that you understand that this process is guided by a shaman. And... the shaman is the one who helps you interact with the spirit world, meaning your soul, meaning your what's going on inside of you, your connection to the God, to the divine. And he can do so through different tools, trance, altered state of consciousness. But the goal is to usually direct the spiritual energy into the physical world and healing. So anything that comes in between that spiritual energy is coming into this world, making it possible. So now, the shaman was working with you and through all of these steps, teaching you how to achieve that, helping you comprehend beyond the material world what was really happening. And so the job of a shaman, if you will, was to support with your genuine efforts for spiritual transformation as well as demonstrating what loving compassion looks like. It was a rigorous discipline. Their role was very, very important, as they were the role models. And to be selected, they had to be considered pure of heart and mind. They had to go through their own emotional and mental cleansing and meditation and isolation, and would often fast and purify their body. So now, the basic rules was that you had to find the right food for man. So it goes back a little bit to the old story about the two wolves, and there's the enraged black wolf and there's the pure tranquil white wolf, and they're both there, and the young man asks his grandfather, well, he's, you know, what am I going to do with those two wolves? He says, the one you feed is the one that is going to live. And so in that sense, finding the right food for man is all over the analogies of the Papa Vol and all of the other mythology surrounding these cultures, meaning you must feed yourself spiritually because you are a spirit, you are a soul. And the way to do that was to overcome self-destructing pride, vanity, or misuse of power, or lying, or gossiping, in order to be able to then be in the light. What was expected of a person at that time was that their heart would be offered to God. Not literally, but more metaphorically. So your heart, you couldn't offer just a bland human heart. So you had to deify your heart. And in order to do so, you had to do a special efforts. You also had to have your true face. Now, Dominguez Cruz refers to, does your mother really know you? And I have three children, and can I say that I really know them? I cannot. They don't tell me everything. I'm not with them at all the time, and I don't know what they're doing. I also don't know what they're thinking. All I know is what I tried to give them and how I was there for them, and even then, doesn't mean that my intention will always receive as I was offering them. So it becomes then your own personal task to know what is your own true face. And so your true face had to match your true heart. This represented spiritual growth. You created a firm and enduring center that you, from which you could operate as a soul-infused human. So it's the same thing I've been saying, right? I'm just trying to explain it in different ways. If your inside are matching your outside, then it's your soul that's talking. It's your soul that's acting, not your ego. And so if you're able to overcome that, then you become your true self, which is, from the get-go, your soul. This was also written in Book of Fate by the Maya. So you have the Book of Fate, you have the Book of Papa Vol, and you have another book. So all of these books are explaining these same ideas over and over in different way. The Book of Fate was written by what's referred to as a compassionate king. The original king that came from the sea. So now we're talking about going as far back as the Nihuas. He came from somewhere in the Atlantic, and some say that it could be Atlantis. Some have more extraordinary theory about Celtic origins, but we're talking about 11,000 years ago, where the Celts were not even in Ireland. So I'm going more with the possibility that it was more of a central located in the Atlantic Ocean, mainly Atlantis, and he came to Mesoamerica. And this is why it could see the close resemblance with the Egyptian and the Greek mysteries, because what influenced the Greek and the Egyptian mysteries came from Atlantis as well. So this is logical If you believe Atlantis existed, of course. Now, I'm going to massacre this name, Quetzalcoatl was said to be filled with love, and that his love was towards all living things. So he couldn't kill a forest bear, but neither could he harm a flower or a tree. There was a time, though, when he did get tempted, and he repented. And his strict repentance, he did the penance inside of a casket. Now, we saw that again. It's not the first time we hear this. Instead of the Christianity where it's 3 days, because it's Mesoamerica, it's 4 days. But they spend in isolation, in rejection of the material world and other temptation, in darkness, for 4 days. In which after, he purifies himself by fire. So, you could say that he really threw himself in the fire, but magically he survived. Or you could say that he received enlightenment, the light. And this light could be considered a flame. And that is now, he's purified by this light. And in other words, he transcended his life as a material person, and it was transmuted by the pure spirit inside of him. So, that it's mythical, or just a story, they all say the same thing. Undeniably, it's the soul's pilgrimage and transformation after birth in the material world into a spiritual being. So, those warriors that we talk about are more basically wearing a psychological war more than an actual physical war. Now, Don Miguel Ruiz explained that the Toltecs did not so much have a religion, and this is where I was wanting to differentiate, right? There's the priest and the shaman. Now, Don Miguel Ruiz is a knight of the Order of Eagle, and he's known to be a Nagal, which is a shaman, of higher wisdom. And so, He starts all of his books saying that the teachings had to go into what's called the underground or mystery school because to protect it from the invaders and the wars and everything. But it survived to this day. But it's not a religion. It's a spiritual system. Okay, so it's very different. We're not asking you to join a church or a cult. We're asking you to understand that it's a way for you to connect with your divinity, right? So the basic of the mystery school is that 3,000 years ago, a man realized that he was made of light and that the space between the stars that form his body was not empty. Now, this is 3,000 years ago. This is before they knew about atoms, before they knew about molecules and all that stuff. But I'm teaching this very thing in my Akashic Record classes. You're made of atoms. The atoms have a nucleus and they have a little electron that go around it. And for the longest time, scientific says, well, there's nothing else because they couldn't measure anything smaller than an electron. And now they can, and it's called quantum energy. Now, this man 3,000 years ago knew of this quantum energy because he had an out-of-body experience and saw that in between the space was light. And when he realized this, he realized that this light was actually everywhere between every single atom. So your body is made of an arrangement of atoms that form molecules that form a human body. But the trees outside and the flowers and the dog is also made of atoms. They're just rearranged differently. And so he realized that all of creation was filled with this light, this quantum energy. And so outside of the body, there was no differentiation between the tree, the dog, or the humans. We were all part of creation. We are all one. This is the basic of the Toltec teaching. We are all connected. And this light is creator. This light is, call it creator, call it universe, call it God. It doesn't matter. It's all the same. So we're all part of this grander, bigger being that forms the entire universe as we know it. And so he came back and he tried to teach this awakening, this enlightenment to his people, saying, you don't need to judge because who you're really judging is yourself. You don't need to harm because who you're harming is yourself. However, the people did not understand. So he then tried to explain that none of this is real. Now, again, I've been teaching this for years, so I'm kind of glad that I'm doing this podcast so I can see that someone else is agreeing with me on this. You're living in a dream. It's a play. I explain it as a play, the Toltec explain it as a dream, but it's the same thing. You're a soul and you decide to enter this play. So you have your own play, which is your life, and you're deciding, okay, well, I need a mom and I need a dad, and who wants a daughter? And then you interconnect your play with other people. But each and every person on earth has their own play, their own dream. And so then we're building this life and we're building these actors into our play. And the only reason why this play works is because we agree to certain things. Now, for one of those things that we agree on is that a dog is a dog. If I say dog, you all know and picture an animal, at the very least on four legs, usually hairy. There's many types of dogs, but it's different than a cat, right? And so as we're learning to perceive the world through language, so using words like grass, flower, sky, sun, our perception becomes clearer, but it's based on our culture, it's based on our family, it's based on our reference. These are very concrete things. Now, even if I say cell phone, you're going to say, okay, but there's a lot of different types of cell phones out there. Say water bottle, it could be a plastic, it could be a reusable one, right? But you have an idea, it's a container, it has water in it. In the same way, we develop our ideas and our beliefs based on our life and what we live and what we see and what we experience. Those perceptions then help us develop a judgment, and that is ego. What is good and what is bad? What makes a good woman? Now, if I ask this in Africa, I'm going to get a very different answer than if I ask in Korea or if I ask in France or if I ask in, I don't know, Hawaii, right? There was a time where skinny women were seen as unable to reproduce and not a good wife. But now the medias are feeding us skinny is better. And then they're feeding us long hair this year, short hair next year. And they're telling us this is what beauty looks like this year. And that's the way they dress. And that's the product they use. And, you know, so our perception and our judgment on what is a good looking woman or what is a good looking man then becomes affected in what we're being fed through the media, through culture, to what's surrounding us. It also starts affecting our internal judgment, our ability to say, am I good or am I bad? And every time you hear, don't do this, you shouldn't do that, then you ask, as a child, you internalize these things and you develop a system of belief. Now, I try to explain that in the same fashion in my own book, the I Dragon book. Because I'm four, and this event occurs, I can't make sense of it because I'm four. And so I internalize the message, which is maybe an erroneous message or a false message or a message that is just for that moment and that single instant only, or maybe not even true. One of the example is I was part of a choir in fifth grade. I sang. Because I was a girl, they asked me to sing as a soprano or alto or whatever. I did not do well. So the teacher said, oh my God, leave the choir. You're terrible. Never sing again. I'm like, okay. Now there's a part of you here that decides, okay, I'm terrible, but I thought I was good. So I guess now that other people are hearing me, I'm going to have to listen to what they say. I'm going to stop singing. But I enjoy singing. I really like it. I play music instruments and singing is part of my joy. But for the longest time, I kept that joy for myself. So I would sing in the shower, I'd sing in the car, I would sing when I was on my own. Until I was at church and I'm singing the hymns like everybody else. And the choir director came to see me and says, I would really like you to join the choir. And so I couldn't help but laugh. I'm like, I'm terrible. Actually, you've never heard me singing. So I was standing right behind you and you have a great tenor voice. I was like, oh, would you look at that? So it's true. I can't sing alto and soprano, but I have a great singing voice. However, for many, many years, I believe the lie that this person in her reality gave me that I was a bad singer altogether, right? So you, in order to defeat the ego, in order to go through this process of resurrection, of rebirth, you need a lot of courage to break free from all these fears that is ruling you, your dream. Sometimes people say, well, how can we change the world, right? Because the world's not a great place and there's violence, there's wars, there's this, there's that. I agree. However, before you get concerned with everybody else, you need to be concerned with yourself. And this is the other thing that I say all the time, which is why I relate to this talk so much, because everything in here is what I've been saying. I'm just using someone else's books to relate what the message I've been relaying to you guys all along. You must first love yourself if you want to be loved. Okay? So if you're looking for a relationship and you're looking for love and you keep meeting the wrong people, well, that's because you're not loving yourself first. So if you can't find anything to love about yourself, how on earth do you expect anyone else to do it? You must first recognize what is beautiful about you, what is unique about you, what is lovable about you for anybody else to see that in you. So in the same way, we need to see what else we're afraid of. And this isn't something new. This is literally what I do for work. People come to me and they want me to tell them. I can, but then that would defeat the entire purpose of introspection. The idea is that you need to find where did this fear come from. And people are terrified to find this huge abyss or this incredibly ugly creature inside of them, which is not what you're going to find. What you're going to find eventually, if you dig far enough, is that you're the divine being. But all along, you've been told that you either weren't good enough, you weren't lovable, you weren't a good singer, you could never do this, and you should never attempt that. And those became part of your belief system, which is what we can say are the lies of the subconscious. And the lies of the subconscious is that little voice in your head that says, oh, you're getting fat, oh, you're not pretty enough, you're not good enough for this, you don't deserve that, right? So this is your ego, because at one point in time, someone told you you weren't a good singer. Don't attempt to sing. What are you doing? Get back into your room. Don't say so loud. Maybe you shouldn't even talk because, you know, your voice is terrible. We need to defeat the ego and all the lies that it's telling us, because the lies come from a pain or a wound that we suffered a long time ago. And so this is what hell looks like. You are living in the hell of all these discouraging things that you keep repeating to yourself, either on a conscious level or subconscious level. Now, sometimes I work with people and people make a mistake and they say, oh, I'm so stupid. And I'm thinking, why are you saying that? You're not stupid. You're learning how to do this. Not getting it perfect the first time is kind of sort of expected. So this is a good time to actually not get it right so we can correct it and you can learn it the right way. So why is it that the message, oh, I'm great at learning this, doesn't come up? And instead, we have the lies that I'm stupid that comes up. And these are all the little things that you need to start observing about yourself. You need to start paying attention to what is the message in my subconscious that is ruling me? Who is driving the bus to my life? So you have to defeat that judgment. You have to defeat this way of thinking. And in order to do that, we need to change the perspective, right? So changing perspective is, oh, well, you're right. I suck at being a soprano, but I'm an excellent tenor. So my perspective has changed. I can still, I sing, I still suck at soprano, but I can sing. I can just sing as a tenor. In the same way, the change in perspective is I'm not stupid. I'm learning how to do this, so eventually I'll get it right. Everything in your life is always in that duality. And so you need to get out of the duality and find a perspective that is true, right? We don't want to keep lying to ourselves, but that will allow you to be in a positive aspect of this growth and this learning. So what is it you're really truly afraid of? Ask yourself, are you afraid of dying? Or are you afraid of living and not being yourself? Because dying isn't hard. Well, dying, for most people, they fall asleep. They just don't wake up. And that's the end of that. But what is it that happens is that when they're dying, they realize, I didn't get to do this. I never got to try that. I hated my job. This is what I wanted to do. So these regrets, right? These regrets fill you up because you let fear rule you instead of joy and love. And so in a way, you're dishonoring your true self. You're dishonoring yourself by trying to keep everybody happy because you're afraid of conflict or you're afraid of rejection. But that doesn't bring you joy. It just brings you misery and regrets. So, I can definitely speak of myself at this point and say, there was a time where I don't like conflicts, and I certainly, just like everybody else, don't like being rejected. So I wouldn't do certain things, and I would agree to help people and do things for them and neglect myself and not respect myself by doing such. Until eventually it became so bad that I had to step up and say enough. And then those people left. But was it really rejection? No, it was just me saying, no, I'm not doing this anymore. And then new people arrive. And because I finally respected myself, because I finally honored myself, and because I finally loved myself enough to say, I need sleep, I can't do this all the time for everybody else, and I need to think of myself, these people honored and respected that in me. So whatever it is that you're looking for, you must first find it inside of you in order to then be able to get it from the outside. In a Toltec tradition, everybody around you is your mirror. And so if someone is lying around you, it means you're lying to yourself. Whatever is reflected in your environment is what's happening inside yourself. If your environment is supportive, if your environment is loving, if your environment is happy, that's because that's what's inside of you. And so it's being reflected in the outside. Now, time is flying by and I want to get to the agreements. There are 5 agreements, 4 written by Don Miguel Ruiz, and the 5th is written in a separate book with him and his son Jose. Not that Don Miguel Ruiz didn't know about the 5th agreement, it just... it's true, his son, that was he was able to finally verbalize it and explain it to the people. However, depending on your perspective, it's not that hard to understand. It's a whole other boat to actually apply it. So these agreements were made with yourself. And so you're trying to defeat the judge, the ego, the victim. That's all part of being infested. The lies is like a parasite, right? It's sucking the life out of you. And so we want to remove this parasite. And so we're making the conscious decision to change our agreement or our belief system in order to, instead of imposing limits and limiting ourselves, we open the doors to all the possibilities. Now, one of the things that I've experienced was that there's people who contacted me after 30 years because they find me on the internet and on YouTube and all that. And they're like, wow, look at, you know, you're writing books, you're having a podcast, you're doing this. You know, everything you ever decided to do, you succeeded. And I'm like, yes, because I didn't have the belief that I couldn't. And I realize in that sense, I'm fairly unique. I always believed that if I take the time to learn to do something, I can do it. That's how everybody else is doing it. They're learning how to do it. And depending on how much time they invested and how much practice they did, then they got better or they abandoned the project. But there's no reason why I can't do what everybody else is doing. I just need to take the time to learn it and to practice it, then I'll just be able to do it. So I didn't have that limiting belief as far as accomplishing things. My limiting belief was with relationship, because in my life, in my history, it's where I got all the lies. It's where I told myself I wasn't good enough, I wasn't worthy of love, and all of those lies is what I had to examine, and I had to remove, and I had to change. So for each and every one of us, there's a journey. And this soul journey is within. And then you have to go see, what are my beliefs? What are the concepts by which I live my life? What is the guiding principle that guides my life? And I often ask this in sessions with people, and they're looking at me like, my value system? I don't know. And you're like, okay, but this is what rules your life. If you don't even know what your value system is, then how can you apply it? That means that there's a lot of things inside of you that are guiding or driving your bus and are not taking you in the right direction, because you don't even know which direction you're going in, because you're not in charge. So the five agreement is, first of all, be impeccable with your words. I teach these agreements in my Reiki class because I think that they're the basic things that we should do to be better ourselves. If we are better to ourselves, then we are going to be a better person in this world. And if everybody makes that effort, then we're going to live in a better world. Yeah? So it means speaking with integrity and to say only what you mean. So sometimes you need to actually slow down and think before you speak. There's nothing wrong with reflecting before you say something, because instead of saying something hurtful, maybe you can rephrase it and say the same meaning, but in a more loving and compassionate way. You avoid using words against yourself. I'm so stupid, I'm an idiot. And also, you avoid gossiping about others. You'd be surprised what gossiping could do. If you look at someone like Hitler, who literally gossiped against the Jews and against this and against that and rallied an entire country to war and did devastating damages. I mean, this is the epitome of gossip, but still. It's someone using their words for power, for violence. So before you're using your own words, ask yourself, is what I'm saying, is what I'm sharing making people happy? Are they making them smile? Is it enriching their life or mine by sharing this information? Or are you just sharing something because you want people to pity you and say, oh, you're so poor, you, oh yeah, you know? What are you doing with your words? So, you know, there's a wise proverb out there that says, if you got nothing to say that's nice, then be quiet. You have to examine the way you talk to others and the way you talk to yourself. What is your inner language? What are you saying? The second agreement is, don't take anything personally, because what I'm doing is based on my own personal experience. And what I'm doing is not meant to insult you or meant to, I don't know, manipulate you. It's done in the best effort, right? But you, based on your background, your culture, you might be offended by what I'm saying. So don't take it personally, because that was the aim or the goal of what I was trying to convey. So the only person that knows you is you. So some people get easily offended and you're like, well, I didn't know this about you, so I'm sorry that offended you, right? And when people say some stuff to you, like I at one point I was called a bad mom by my ex-husband, and I stood there and I remember being like, what? And I wondered, so does that resonate with me? Am I really truly a bad mom? And I spent a minute or two thinking about it, and I'm like, no, that I don't relate to that. So I'm not going to take her personally, because that's his opinion and a reflection of his perception. And so I can't engage with that because that doesn't apply to me. So I just let it go. That was a true growth on myself. And that's when I started realizing that can be said about anything. Why is it when someone says, oh, you're beautiful, you say, oh, thank you. And then someone next 5 minutes later says, oh, you're fat and you're ugly. And then that affects you. And then you get stuck on that. If neither should affect you, do you feel pretty? Do you feel beautiful? That's what matters. When people, it's funny because I constantly get told, oh, you lost weight. Oh, you gained weight. Oh, you lost weight. And yeah, I'm wearing the same clothes. I weigh the same thing. I've weighed the same thing for years now. So I'm not losing. I'm not gaining. Mind you, I might be bloated. Why is it that with that particular person, I'm fat and I need to lose weight. And with the other person, I'm absolutely beautiful and look like I even lost weight. It's their perception. It comes from their own life, their own play, and their own inner talk. And so by not taking it personally and just using your own radar to judge where you're at, then you can definitely improve your life and be a happier person. Because you'll be immune to the opinions and the actions of others, and you won't suffer needlessly every time someone makes a comment. I remember one of my students said, oh, you can be brutal. And I'm thinking, okay, but I wasn't violent. She says, oh, no, 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 no. I said, I didn't raise my voice. She's like, no. I said, okay. Well, sometimes when someone touches the truth, and the truth is often a very open sore or a deep wound, and we touch it, no matter how gentle we do it, then it kind of hurts. It provokes a reaction. People come to me to hear that truth. So after we had this conversation, she realized, yes, I needed to hear that. And I'm like, there you go. But since we're surrounded by constant lies, hearing the truth all of a sudden becomes out of the ordinary and something that sometimes people feel they need to protect themselves. But if you speak the truth, if you know what the truth is for you, then nobody else can judge you with that. Your truth is your own. It belongs to you, just like your emotions are your own. Your emotions belong to you. There's an episode in my life where I said I felt betrayed, and someone looked at me and was like, well, isn't that too big of a word? I said, how would you know? You weren't in my shoes. You did live through that experience. I felt betrayed. Those are my words because that's my experience. And to deny me that expression is to deny me those emotions. And I refuse to be denied what I was feeling. So when someone says, well, I'm hurt, that it was your intention or not to hurt them, you have to honor the fact that that's how it was received on the other side. And if your intention was not to hurt them, then you simply say, that was not my intention, I'm sorry. Instead of reacting violently and starting a big fight. You have to own your own words, which go back to speak impeccably. So watch your words because they can be hurtful. But then again, you don't want to take things personally because sometimes it has nothing to do with you. It has to do with that own person's experience and their own interpretation of what's happening. Which leads us to the third agreement. Don't make any assumptions. Find the courage to ask questions and to express what you actually want. Because then the person might say to you, like, let's say, I'll give you a stupid example. I go into a bakery and I say, hey, I want a sandwich with ham. And they're going to look at you and say, well, we have bread, but we're simply a bakery here. We're not a cafe. We don't make sandwiches. Oh, you say, well, the bakery I usually go to, they do have sandwiches that they offer made with their own bread. You say, well, that's fantastic, but we don't offer that here. Now, would you still like bread to make your own sandwich or would you like to go somewhere else? You see, then the bakery doesn't take it personally and just saying, I'm glad you're asking. I'm glad you're here. However, whatever it is that you are asking, I cannot provide for you. And so because of that, I won't take it personally. Yeah. But you didn't make the assumption and you didn't get mad when the person said, no, I can't give you a sandwich. To make the assumption, oh, you don't like me today, you're rude to me, and so forth and so on. You simply say, oh, okay, so what I'm asking, you can't give, so I'll go somewhere else and get it. This is the same thing about emotions. If you're asking someone to console you, and they don't even understand what they're doing, or they're not the right person for you, and they say, I can't do this for you, don't make the assumption, ask the questions. Communicate clearly to avoid the misunderstanding, because the misunderstanding often leads to the drama, which causes sadness and anger and a lot of other things. In the Korean shows I've been watching lately, the whole basis of the dramas is that there's assumptions, half-truths, and secrets. That's what creates the drama. So if you don't want drama in your life, take all those things out. Be truthful, express yourself clearly, and when there's something you don't understand, don't assume. Ask, is this what you mean? If that's not what you mean, what did you mean? Explain it to me, because this I don't understand. My son was raised not to make assumptions because he's autistic. So he doesn't understand nonverbal cues, and he understands language very literally. So in order to be able to communicate, one of his tools was make sure you ask a lot of questions so that you understand their clear expectation. What is it they want? What is it that you are asked to do? And does that limit myself? Or can I go a row around that? Or what is my possibilities? The same thing can be said about a relationship or a marriage. You enter a marriage. One person says, of course it's going to be this way. And the other person says, oh, of course it's going to be this way. And all of a sudden, they realize it's not. Some people were not happy that some places offer marriage counseling classes before the marriage. And these are the very questions you need to answer. You know, what do you see your role as a husband? Oh, well, I'm going to go to work and I'm going to come home. I'm going to meet the boys on the weekend. And then, okay, so who does the dishes? Who does the groceries? Who does the cleaning? Who does the laundry? Who mows the lawn? Oh, well, she can take care of the house. I'm going to take care of the outside. Okay, so how do you feel about that? Was that your expectation? In some cases, they'll say yes. In some other cases, they're going to hold on a minute. I go to work every day. I don't mind going to groceries, but I'm not doing the laundry. And then you realize that because there was assumption made, then there's conflict after. So it's always good to be, clear. What are your expectations? And it doesn't matter if it's a relationship, if it's a business partner, if it's about money, status, behavior, the way you're going to dress. Now you're invited to a marriage. What kind of marriage is it? How should I dress? Should I wear a scarf over my head in church? Don't assume that people know, because that's not part of their culture. It's not part of their reference, right? So this is all about what it is. Don't make assumptions, and then you won't feel like you're uncomfortable or you made a mistake or you offended someone. Now, the fourth agreement is to always do your best. And your best will change from moment to moment, from day to day. On a good day, I'm smiling, I'm dancing, I'm singing. And on another day, I have my periods, I'm full of cramps, and I just want to be left alone in my bed. And that's the best I can do that day. So you have to ask yourself, is this the best I can do? And if the answer is yes, then you've done your best. Nothing is asked more of doing your best, but you should do less. This, one of the example is that, how long should I meditate? Okay, well, how long are you good at? Because if I'm asking you to meditate 10 minutes every day and you do it very well, as opposed to doing 1 hour and you're always distracted, well, there's going to be more progress made if you just do 10 minutes at your very best and 1 hour fully distracted, right? So when you're doing something, you have to ask yourself, how best can I do this? And every day is a new day, so you can always do better the next day. You can learn from what you have experienced today, because they're not mistakes. They're always learning experience. And then you can transform the next day and you can become better, right? As just as someone who practices the piano, obviously, after years of practice, they'll do better. So, but their best when they first started learning was the best they could do as far as that exercise was concerned at that time. If something doesn't bring you pleasure, I can assure you, you're not doing it at your best. You're going to do something at your best if you're happy about it. If it brings you joy, that is when you do it best. So if the thing that brings me the most joy is to lay in my bed with a heating pad watching TV for a day, then that's what I'll be doing. Because everything else will be miserable, I'll be complaining about it, I'll be grumpy, and I won't do a good job. So whatever it is you do, you always have to ask yourself, does this make me happy? Does this bring you joy? The fifth agreement is to see the reality with your eyes of truth. Now, this again is one day at a time, but the reality is that you are a divine being. And as you remove all the lies that you've been told and all the limitation that you've internalized, and that you become yourself, which is a soul, and you realize that you're actually divine, and that in each and everything in this world is infused with the divine, then you learn to love yourself, and you learn yourself to self-respect, and you continue to develop this compassion inside of you. And as you do this, you will free yourself from your old beliefs and freely express yourself in who you are. And who you are can be anything, but being able to really say, this is what I like, this is what I enjoy, and not feel like you're being judged. This complete acceptance of yourself just as you are, the complete acceptance of everybody as they are, is the fifth agreement. So, therefore, you must learn to, what are the lies you're telling yourself? What are the wounds that you're carrying inside of you? Healing those with the help of the four agreements, recognizing your divinity, embracing the divinity as a divine being, expressing love and compassion, true forgiveness of the actions of others, and forgiving yourself, you can then completely accept everybody that surrounds you. This is accomplished through the mastery. The mastery through the Toltec is the mastery of awareness. You must first know yourself. That's the mastery of awareness. Then there's the mastery of transformation. So I'm resuming again, right? You have to identify your old belief. You have to stop victimizing yourself, and you have to stop judging yourself. Once you do that, you live with new agreements and new belief. And then through the mastery of awareness and transformation, you learn the mastery of love. So it's the love of life itself. It's the love of yourself. It's the love of everything. You see the world through the eyes of a child. You see through the eyes of wonder. You see the beauty without judgment. I was in the desert at first, and I was like, wow, it's empty. It's only once I've been there and imbued myself with the energy of the desert and observed the life there that I saw the beauty. Because at first I judged it from my perspective of, to me, beauty is lush green flowers, this and that. And then I saw that there are flowers, there is animals, there is beauty, there's wonderment to be seen. And so now whenever I go somewhere, I try to see through the eyes of a child. This is the first time I'm seeing this. Look at everything I can look at. Look at the beauty that is in everything. When you become a true master, as per the Toltec tradition, you reclaim your divinity and you become one with God. So now, the art of transformation, the discipline of the warrior. There we go. So the discipline of the warrior is not about fighting or going to war. It's about healing. And the only way to heal is to forgive yourself and others. You need to control your emotions. Therefore, your own personal power becomes yours and not just an expression or a reaction. And you change your fear-based agreement to escape the hell you're in, because if you're not happy, you're in hell, to create your own personal heaven, which is on earth. The last part is this initiation of the dead. The initiation of the dead is an exercise where you imagine, if you have one life to live, which kind of person are you going to be? Are you going to be the one that's depressed and whines and cries and thinks life is over already, even though you still have a whole week to live? Or are you going to own it and you're going to say, okay, so what are my regrets? What can I fix? Who can I forgive? What can I let go? What can I change? This is a way of the initiation of the dead, is meaning that you observe your material life and you realize what's important and what is not, what can be let go and what you want more.